Hello, my name is Gareth Edwards, and welcome to the Untitled History Podcast. Join me each week alongside world-leading experts as we take a deep dive into your favorite topics from throughout history. From the ancient world to the modern, and with plenty of historical rabbit holes in between, we'll cover famous and not so famous moments in history from all across the globe. From as early as 7,000 years before the Common Era, we have evidence suggesting cats served alongside humans on ships. This isn't just in a civilian capacity. As long as there have been warships, cats have served on them around the world. This is a tradition that has extended well into the modern era. At least 12 cats are known to have been present at the D-Day landings in June 1944. There are also almost certainly more felines present in those critical early hours than dogs. Cats would continue to have an official presence on Royal Navy vessels until they were officially banned in 1975, and just how rigorously that ban has been enforced remains a question sometimes today. Individual ships' cats have sometimes been the subject of articles, videos, and podcasts. What's often not covered in detail, though, is why cats were so important on ships, and how ships throughout the ages managed their presence. So today, in this episode, we're going to explore both the history and the logistics of one of the most critical elements of naval history, the ship's cat. I am, as always, your host, Gareth Edwards, aka John Bull. And with me today is my good friend, naval historian Alex Pocklington, who will be better known to many of you, I suspect, as Drakinophel.
Hello.
And this is a subject that both of us have written and broadcast about before, isn't it? It's one that's close to both our hearts, I think.
Yeah, the cat is one of those, it's one of those amusing things in the main histories you'll find of ships, they're almost never mentioned. The minute you scratch the surface and you do a deeper dive, they just show up.
Yeah.
Whether it be in photos or accounts or, you know, people who were there, their stories, and sometimes even sneaking into the official documentation of photos.
I think that's it. I mean, both of us visit battleships and ships semi-regularly, I'd say, together. And I think that there was, with others who've been there with them, there's a bit of a standing joke that the moment we hit a ship that neither of us has been to before, your first instinct is to see if you can climb the masts. And my first instinct is to try and see if I can find a veteran who can tell me about the ship's cats.
Yeah.
it's that thing of like, they are a bit of a vital history, but a bit of a forgotten history, I think, in naval terms. And I think there are some good books and good articles about it, but I think the goal today is really for you listeners is to make you think a bit about what it actually means having a cat on a ship, because it's more complex than the initial surface thoughts about it and the role they play. I mean, maybe just to open, I'll give people a bit of a rough idea of the timescales we're talking about here. But like, the domestication of cats starts to happen really in what's known as the sort of the Fertile Crescent. And we're talking in that sort of from about, you know, about 3500 BCE, but before the Common Era is when the first domestication starts happening. But we have evidence that they have lived alongside humans in a capacity since probably about 9000 BCE. And that Fertile Crescent, for those who aren't familiar with it, think about the sort of the bit of northern Egypt up through sort of Syria into Palestine and across into almost an arcing boomerang shape into Iraq. It's the fertile bit of those valleys where human civilization starts. But it's sort of traditionally the sort of believed that it's the Egyptians that start that domestication process, isn't it?
Yeah. I mean, they're where you start to see the most depictions of them. Obviously, the Egyptians were rather prolific in depicting everything around them. But the Egyptians, they had various cat-based goddesses. They had cults of cats, like the temples of Bast and so forth, which always, at least a joke I heard years ago, which is, you know, cats were once worshipped as gods by humans, and they have not forgotten this.
Yeah, very much so, I think. And what fascinates me a lot is, and we're talking about both sides of this here, because there's almost this cohabitation period that exists. And this is very clear in the archaeological record, in the genetic record even, that although it's probably around sort of the 3500s BCE when the domestication happens, unlike dogs get domesticated very fast in kind of terms. But what we see with cats is that there's a very extended period of almost cohabitation, that humans let them exist alongside us, and the cats don't particularly want to be domesticated, and that continues for a long time. And what that on land, that's very much about, well, it's about grain, isn't it?
Yeah. Yeah. It's, you know, the cat is, and this will come into play when it comes to ships as well. The cat is a very agile creature. And that means that if you've got mice or rats or whatever else in your grain silos, and your storage, a cat can get into all sorts of interesting places, pretty much almost anywhere that a rodent can. And they are quick, and unlike dogs, because dogs are very good at ratting, not quite so good at taking out mice, but mice are actually a bigger problem when it comes to grain. Yeah. And because the cats will use their claws and their teeth to take out rodents, they're somewhat more effective, especially in a kind of a very 3D environment like a grain silo or something. And the other handy thing is that cats tend to catch their prey, and then they tend to take it elsewhere to finish it off or eat it, which is also very handy if you don't want unfortunate bits of rodent left in your grain.
Yeah, and that cohabitation period, there was a really good paper recently actually that pushed it back and pushed the locations differently again, and really pushed that traditionally you've got this thought that it's Egypt where it all kicks in, but there's actually an increasing amount of evidence that suggests that it's really North Africa broader is where this starts happening. And there was even, there's evidence, for example, in Cyprus from about 7,000 BCE, where you've got people, a bloke being buried alongside his cat. And that's critical almost to our narrative here, to what we're talking about today, because cats are not native to Cyprus, which means as early as 7,000 BCE, even before we know that really they're being domesticated, even at that point, they're now part almost of maritime history, because they must be, or they wouldn't be on Cyprus.
Yeah. And the other thing you ought to remember is that we're talking about a span of time where cats, as they start to come about in as a semi-domestic and then domestic pet in the Middle East, they are kind of actually, they're almost survivors of another age, because we look at the Sahara and everyone's like, yeah, it's a desert. Well, that long ago, it wasn't. There was substantially more greenery, and cats, as you kind of see even today now, modern jungle cats and stuff, cats are not desert creatures. At least the ones that the domesticated cat is now descended from, they are jungle hunters, and that's the era they've come from. And then as you've got desertification gradually turning the Middle East into what it is today, and even what it is during most of what we would consider to be properly recorded history, they have survived in large part because they have learned to work alongside humans. Because their native environment is long gone from the area that they originally would have come from.
And I think that adaptability is something that plays hugely, I think, into why they become a very maritime animal. Which I always feel slightly ironic to me as I won't call myself a cat owner, but as a cat host, outside of, say, Bengals, domestic cats really generally don't like water. But yet they're this very suitable animal for maritime purposes. And we should probably start to talk about that. I mean, you're an ancient Egyptian mariner. Maybe actually what's really useful is, if you're an ancient Egyptian mariner, what are you actually doing what is your role? What are you doing? What is your ship doing?
So in terms of ancient Egypt, there are essentially two primary types of, if you like, long distance sailing going on, because obviously you have a lot of fishing and so forth, but that tends to be within a couple of miles of wherever you happen to live, and you're going out and coming back in the same day. But in terms of longer distance travel, you've got trade and movement of goods along the Nile, obviously. So you're sailing up and down, and that can actually, I mean, okay, you don't necessarily need much to keep pests away from an obelisk, but there at various points in Egyptian history, depending on how organized or how rebellious they're feeling at that time, there are actually quite complex networks that involve taking various foodstuffs and perishable goods up and down the Nile from places where it's produced to places where it's needed. Because the fields around Thebes or Memphis or or Pi Ramsey or Amarna, they don't produce enough to feed those cities as they get bigger. So you need to bring food in. And we're talking about an era where there's not any kind of mechanized transport. Obviously, there won't be for thousands of years at that point. And even where there are roads, there's a limit to what you can transport by road. Whereas you can comparatively stick absolutely vast amounts of food on ships. And especially in a civilization like Egypt, where almost every city is either directly on the Nile or Nile adjacent, it's actually very easy to get stuff to where it needs to go. So that's one form of maritime transport. The other thing is trade. So you've got Mediterranean trade and trade in what we would now call the Red Sea and the western coast of the Indian, western side of the Indian Ocean. That's rarer because the vast majority of Egyptian craft are made of papyrus, which is great for riverine transport. And yes, there have been expeditions in the 20th century that show you can sail a papyrus craft very long distances.
I always say just because you can sail a papyrus craft vast distances doesn't mean you would.
It doesn't mean you want to. And those, you know, Mediterranean trade and what trade with what they would call like Kush and places like that, kind of roughly Ethiopia, Somalia area now, that is conducted, but it's more conducted with wooden ships. But it's rarer, partly because trade will come to Egypt, especially once the Phoenicians become a thing. But also, if you've been to Egypt, there's not a huge number of trees. And what does grow there isn't really usually that suitable for shipbuilding. So a lot of the Egyptian trade tends to be, we will need to import wood from elsewhere. And you know, that costs money, in which we will then use to build ships, which we will then send out on trade. So there is a certain degree of long distance trade going on, which obviously they need mariners to do. And that is kind of, depending on what you read, it's either very coastal, as you would see with later Greek trade and so forth, hopping from port to port to port on a day-to-day basis. But then you also have some evidence and some even accounts, legends and so forth, about much longer voyages that are where they're at sea for multiple days, even possibly a few weeks at a time, which is believable given some of the places they reach and the fact there really aren't that many places you could stop on the way. But it's still somewhat limited compared to the Greco-Phoenician voyages that you'll get later on. But it still definitely is a thing, which obviously then the longer you're out at sea, the more careful you have to be with rationing what supplies you've got, especially in that era when ships aren't that large.
And I think this leads nicely into when we talk about the spread of the cat. The spread of the cat is actually as much maritime as it is anything else. And you touched on it there, that it's as time progresses, as trade in the Mediterranean starts to pick up, as new players arrive in that trade, as people like the Phoenicians arrive, as we see more trade across North Africa, as the Greeks start to get involved, right through and beyond into the Roman era and all those periods, what that starts to do is it starts to bring this exposure to seafaring and seafaring techniques and useful tools. So as we talk about the Egyptian shift over time towards wooden boat building, but also those skills and things that, like the usefulness of a cat, are going to progress outwards. You know, if you're a Phoenician visiting an Egyptian port and they've got domesticated cats, or you're going to chat to other sailors and it's going to say, "Well, you got a mice problem." Well, you know, one of these things. You stick one of these things on your boat, like that's going to help. And we've kind of focused here on so far on that rodent hunter side of things. That's not the only reason you want a cat on your ship, is it?
No, I mean, there's a few different reasons. Obviously, you've got it stops the rodents eating your supplies. It could be your cargo or your actual food supplies. Also, I mean, rodents aren't very picky. They will eat almost everything if they can do. So
I love that one of the reasons that cats persevere to stay on naval vessels for so long is that the rodents just keep finding new things to eat on naval vessels. So once we start entering the era of wiring, Like, suddenly it becomes even more important to have multiple cats on naval vessels because the bloody mice and rats keep eating your freaking control wires.
Yeah. And then, of course, you've got just generally disease. Because, yeah, okay, we're talking about, you know, a couple of thousand years ago, people don't necessarily have the same modern concept of medicine and disease that we do. But people are still pretty good at pattern recognition. And it's like, well, you know, that boat went out with a cat and didn't have many mice and they came back fine. That one went out without a cat and had a big mouse problem. Also, everyone died of disease. You know, there's a fairly strong correlation there. Maybe we should have a cat. Especially, you know, that old ancient Greek philosophy of like, if we take this thing away, is this thing still a thing? And you can kind of see the although it does lead to some very funny outcomes, you can kind of see the logic of, well, this one had a cat and this one didn't. Well, maybe the cat has something to do with why there isn't the disease.
And actually, we should mention rope as well. You know, like rodents eat rope, and you kind of need a lot of rope and functional rope and secure rope, particularly, you know, throughout this period and beyond. So, and I think
of where that rope is stored as well.
Yeah,
you know, spare rope would be stored below decks where it's dark and damp and warm, which is perfect for rodent nests. So not only will they eat the rope, they'll also leave lots of little offerings on the rope, which can then rot the rope. So even if they haven't eaten it, you might hoist it, and then the next thing you know, it's just snapped because it's gotten moldy.
Yeah.
And then, of course, you've got the whole thing, as we mentioned, you've got Egyptian goddesses like Bast and Sekhmet and so forth. There is also the kind of, almost all sailors are superstitious, especially back then. So there would be a lot of the idea of, well, this animal is a representative of this deity. And we know the Egyptians had loads of cat cults. So, you know, pick one. And if we therefore have the deity's avatar on our ship, then the deity will protect us from some of the ravages of the sea.
And this goes back, I think, also to what you were saying earlier about this cause and effect belief as much as anything else. It's the superstition in cats, and cats being an important thing to have on your vessel, continues for millennia across all areas of the world. And I think so much of that is because there are so many random, almost micro positives that come from having a cat on a ship, right up through to the age of, you know, the golden age of sail and beyond, that those cumulative benefits do over time accrue into an increased chance of a ship functioning well and coming back. And people do notice that. And as you say, they might not necessarily know all the factors going into it, but they see the outcome. And that creates a superstition. And that creates this belief that cats are a lucky thing to have on your vessel, particularly when mascots generally have always been seen as a thing that ships should have. And a cat is a dual purpose item. It can be your mascot, but it's also a functional mascot in a way that, say, having a ship's goat is less functional. So I don't think we should overlook that perception of them as being useful. And also that in terms of, we'll talk a bit later about how they're maintained on vessels. Cats are actually very, very easy to maintain in a clean way on vessels, on ships. But finally, I think it's worth pointing out that there is also a sort of biological benefit to having a cat on a ship, particularly early on in that period, which is they're much more sensitive to barometric pressure changes than humans are. If you've got a cat at home, you will notice this. You might not have noticed it yet. You will after this podcast, which is that generally speaking, if there's a big, massive change in weather coming, a thunderstorm or something like that, your cat will probably pick up on it about an hour before we do as human beings, because of the nature of the sensitivity of their ears and just to the changes in atmospheric pressure. It's one of the things that contributes to zoomies. You know, we know it as zoomies. Your cats will become distressed when there's the sign of a big storm approaching. And ancient sailors aren't stupid, are they? They notice that.
No. Yeah, I mean, you see that all the way through history, even in like World War I and World War II, when there are ships, cats with kittens, and, you know, just randomly, all of a sudden, the cat might have its kittens up in high in the superstructure because it's a nice sunny place and easy access to food. But then there's several accounts where people suddenly say, hang on, the ship's cat isn't moving all of the kittens down below. You know, clear what's up with this? And they're thinking, okay, something bad is going to happen. And then 2 hours later, the ship's being thrown around like a toy in the worst gale or storm that they've possibly come across. Oh, okay, that's what it means. And yeah, like you say, people back in ancient times, they would very quickly have gone, oh, okay. So when the cat, because they don't like water, which is, I mean, it's one of the advantages they have over dogs, because ship's dogs are certainly a thing, but they're gradually outcompeted by the cats a lot of the time. But, you know, if a cat senses a major weather change coming, it's not going to jump over the side. They are not going to go into the sea, and they're going to look for the nearest available shelter. So if the cat that's been happily out on the deck suddenly decides it's going to go to the deepest, darkest part of the hold it can possibly find, you know, you probably should be preparing yourself for something rather bad, which can be, it can be the difference between life and death.
And this, I think, feeds certainly in those early times, it feeds into this perception of cats being lucky as a naval resource. It's why the Vikings have, you know, I love the idea that we have these images of Vikings, and obviously they're big, scary Vikings is the popular image. And that in itself is not necessarily true. But there's considerable evidence to suggest that a considerable percentage of Viking ships sailed with a cat. And I just love the idea we've got of this, these Vikings turning up to raid Lindisfarne, and there's just a cat washing itself on the bow. And I'm not sure if that makes the incoming raid look scarier or less scary, like the nonchalance of that. But yeah, Freya, the Norse goddess Freya, I think one of her aspects is luck. I mean, her carriage is pulled by cats. Like, I mean, she literally herds cats. I mean, that's an ability to have as a goddess. But I mean, yeah, this continues, doesn't it? Right on through into, as you say, into the modern era. Like, I mean, how does that change as ships become bigger? So how does that change how you, almost the cat levels you need on a functioning vessel?
So it's quite interesting because, as we said, that you do have ship's dogs in some cultures as well. Very often they're kind of terrier size things for obvious reasons. They're very good at ratting and stuff like that. But as ships get larger and more complex, the cat actually starts to displace the dog. And even in World War II, you'll have ship's dogs around. While some of them are functional, you start to see the dogs becoming more and more mascots, or they're like an officer's personal pet or something. Whereas the cats essentially almost entirely occupy the functional member of the crew role. And that's for a couple of reasons. Firstly, as you mentioned, you know, with cables and all sorts of other modern equipment, there's even more things for rodents to chew. And those things tend to be more and more important. Also, there's an increase in very narrow confined spaces, which cats are really good at getting into and out of, and they're places you absolutely do not want rodents to be. And also their agility, because, you know, back in, you know, ancient Egyptian times, Greek times, if you're lucky, your ship has a covered deck and an open deck. Okay, so most forms of animal can probably make it up and down one deck. When you're into, say, the Dreadnought period, and you've got 6, 7, 8 plus decks, and you're talking about vertical ladders and a lot of metal, which isn't the grippiest substance in the world, suddenly an animal that's incredibly agile and can jump and pounce and drop from great heights and so forth, that animal can make its way up and down through your ship with great ease, which means that you don't have to worry so much about where's it gone, because it can, almost anywhere it can get, it can also get out of.
This is why I like to think that the other animal that's equally sensitive to barometric pressure changes as cats never got traction as a naval mascot, which is elephants. Yeah. Elephants are equally sensitive, and elephants also get the zoomies, which is terrifying as a thought. But not
a good thing to happen on a ship.
Yeah, not really what you want on your ship is an elephant with the zoomies.
They had enough problems moving horses around, let alone.
Yeah, exactly. but this, because we in this period, and this is certainly as we move again into the height of the Age of Sail and beyond into sort of World War I and World War II, this is where we'll start to see, won't we, that you'll have potentially have more than one cat on a ship. You might have an engineering cat, or one that mostly confines itself to those engineering spaces, and you might have one that's more of a deck cat or upper decks cat. And that's not true on every vessel, because vessels are different sizes, but that's often the case, particularly on like battleships and things, isn't it? It's often you'll have two or three cats.
And particularly in the 18th and the 19th century, so we're talking about the big age of sail ships trending into the ironclads. Various navies at various points actually try to mandate that, you know, if your ship is of a certain size, you should have a certain number of cats on board, because you're getting to the point where a ship is probably actually a bit too large. I mean, a single cat will probably happily tour the entire ship, but it can't be in all the parts of the ship long enough to do its job. At which point, as you said, you know, you have maybe a cat that likes living down below, another cat that likes living up high, and another couple that are kind of indifferent about roughly where they are. And they can, between them, control the rodent population, among other things, because with a big ship with that many hiding spaces, you will get rodents and they will get everywhere. It's one of the major problems, actually, the 2nd Pacific Squadron has on its way around the world. They don't have a huge number of cats, and you end up with huge mouse and rat problems on various ships, which leads to some rather comical ways of trying to control the population, including officers lying in their hammocks and taking pot shots with their pistols as rats scuttle along the pipework with the obvious ricochet issues.
I'd say a cat is a more efficient method of rodent control than the old pistol, but I do think that's very American.
Yeah, well, the funny thing is, as they transit across the Indian Ocean and then into the Pacific, you actually see them start to, because obviously, I mean, Russia's never been a particularly cat-friendly place because it's freezing.
Exactly.
But as they transit across the Indian Ocean, especially they call it Madagascar, and then in the, what today is roughly speaking, Indonesia, you see them experimenting with animals. And they're kind of like, there are so many rodents. What animal do you have that is good at killing rodents? Which at one point at least one ship has several large poisonous snakes, which of course are, you know, they're excellent at catching a rat.
Yeah.
And then they kind of sit there for a week digesting it. And occasionally bite people who come past, which isn't brilliant. And by the time they actually get towards the Pacific, a bunch of the ships have cottoned onto the idea of, hey, maybe we should cap cats. They're pretty useful.
But I think you get that. I mean, you used the example of the Russians and that, and as I say, with the Pacific Fleet, that transition. I think that's also a good example of back to how logistics plays into this, because there's different, particularly naval stations. You see this in accounts of based on where your ship is stationed, I've seen reports where it will talk about the minimum number of cats you need changes based on where you're going to be based. Because, for example, if you're based in somewhere like Hong Kong, the expectation is you will damn well need a ship's cat because you are going to get a serious rodent problem. It is going to happen. Whereas actually, if you're based, say, in Portsmouth, there's less of a requirement for it. Because there's a general expectation that levels of logistical cleanliness around are going to be easier. So the importance varies on that. And I think maybe actually this is the point for us to talk a bit about two things. One we touched on already, which is it's just really hard to find information about this. And then I think what we'll talk about a bit beyond that, the thing that's hardest to find information about, which is how ships made sure that cats could effectively poo on them, how they managed, like, excrement, because we've talked about them being a useful hygiene tool, but they also generate their own hygiene problems as well. But I mean, firstly, my personal experience of this, this is a topic that's always fascinated me. And there are some, as I say, some good books about this, some good firsthand accounts that we find, but they are scattered. And I think that speaks to that cats are seen as such an element of just usual normality on a ship that they're not really covered. And because they're never, they're rarely mentioned in explicit naval regulations or documentation outside of general recommendations. We don't have that sort of informational basis, that hard document sourcing basis for how they have been managed throughout the ages that we do with other aspects of ship logistics, do we?
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, it gives you some idea of just how integrated they are into the day-to-day. It's kind of like almost things like they're integrated at a level that's almost the same as the ship's rations. It's like the only reason we know much about what sailors ate is usually because either we've got records from ports where they're, you know, stockpiling and going, okay, we've got this much beef, this much pork and so forth. But when you actually look at the records from the ships themselves, the only time you ever really find people writing about the food is when they're complaining that something's gone horribly wrong with it. but we know that they're eating at least three meals a day, but we just, there's very little about it. And that's something that's pretty vital to keeping your ship going. And it's a similar thing with cats. They're not stocking vast catteries in Portsmouth. So there's not that kind of behind the scenes.
I now have the lovely vision of the naval catteries at Portsmouth.
Here, take one standard issue tabby.
Yeah, exactly. Sir, I've been sent for a tuxedo.
But yeah, so as a result, the only times you'll tend to see cats pop up in the records is either when they've done something remarkable that's saved the ship, or they've done something that's annoyed someone enough to write about it, or very very occasionally something rather spectacular has happened that means people have gone, oh, that also the cat did this. And of course, then you've got the implication that that cat was always there.
Yeah, yeah. But the implication is the cat's always there. There's just no one mentioned that. And the ones I've tended to notice that you get are everyone suddenly discovering that the cat they thought was a boy is actually a girl, and then finding that out because someone's found a bunch of kittens in one of the gun barrels. You know, it's, or someone complaining because they've been on extended duty of cleaning up after the cat, or someone reporting that they have a new commander that may be pro or anti cat. Those tend to be the things that come through in sailors' letters and in sort of individual accounts. But as you say, they're the moments where something unusual happens. The normality of a cat being on the ship is just accepted. It's just there. And that does make it incredibly hard to dig into from a historical perspective. But let's talk a bit, though, about how cats are managed on ships. Because, as I say, hygiene is critical. And that does bring with it implications. And I think this is the thing that people think least about when they think about cats is, you know, to put it at the basest question is how cats poo on ships. So let's jump right back to the beginning again, and we'll just race through this. But like Egyptian era, like really, as you say, single decks, at most you've got one covered thing. Cats are generally quite clean. They will tend to defecate in the same places. They will return to the same places. What they're generally looking for is a bit of a sheltered place to do it in, or not necessarily undercover, but in a space that almost is like, same way as cats like sitting in boxes. They want a space like that. And on decks of ships going back to throughout the years, you have that, don't you? Because you have things like cord rope and all of that. And those decks are washed very, very frequently, aren't they?
Yeah. Yeah. You've got rope. A lot of places, certainly in the Mediterranean, you'd have like a tent. Essentially, what we would think of as either a tent or a gazebo style thing set up on near the stern, which is because you've got things like, you know, the steersman always has to be there and you don't want to leave him baking in the sun all day. Depending on the ship design, but sometimes you also have a very high prow, which might create a small sheltered area. But as you say, you know, the cats generally, they tend to be creatures of habit. So once you know, that's the place the cat wants to go to do its business, then you know, okay, well, either set something up like a little basket or something that's easier to get to deal with, or, you know, whoever's annoyed the captain that day gets cleanup duty. But being predators, cats usually they have relatively minimal waste period, and it tends to be, unless something's badly wrong with them, it tends to be relatively easy to dispose of.
And so, I think what you've hit on there is the thing that the listener, if you've never thought about this, is litter trays are one of the oldest things that exists, and they exist precisely because you needed to deal with cats on naval vessels. And the history of naval history is almost a history of the evolution of the litter tray as much as it is anything else. I mean, and like you say, that might start in the ancient Egyptian era with baskets, with everything else. There's almost two aspects to what you're dealing with here, which is one, providing a place for the cat to go, but also, in ideally, you want to provide some material they can go in, which is going to make your purposes of cleaning this up easier. And I think it's really, we can say it's once you start getting into that age of sail, isn't it, that changes in terms of county management. And that's when you start getting, there's almost an accidental benefit here in two things that you tend to get a lot on sailing vessels, isn't there?
Yeah, we've got sand, yeah. Which is everywhere. Sand for battle, sand for sand and small rocks are used actually to trim the ship as for mobile ballast, because people sometimes don't realize ship's ballast is made up of a fixed ballast that's usually very big lumps of either stone or iron, and then there'll be a slightly movable ballast of bigger rocks, and then there'll be a loose ballast, which will either be the cargo if you're in a cargo ship, and supplies and so forth, but also will tend to be things like sandbags and other easily man-portable items. So that means you've got a ready supply of that kind of stuff that's available.
And you also get large quantities of ash. And I think that's the other thing. So you've got this sand, you've got ash, you can mix them together, you can do whatever else. And you've now got a substance you can put in your what we will now, correctly, I don't know, we've kind of can genuinely call a litter tray, and that you will use that. And ships have carpenters. I think people forget that. Certainly, it's easy to forget that once you hit this age of, you know, your third rate, your second rate, your third rate, these are almost mobile towns in their own way, these ships. They're big enough to act like that. And that means they have things like ship's carpenters. And it's very easy to go to your ship's carpenter and say, you know, Dave, we need can you just knock together a quick wooden box that we can put down for the cat? We can shove some sand in, bit of ash, and then we'll stick it where the cat normally goes, and hopefully they'll go. And that kind of continues right on up into, as we hit sort of the modern era of shipping, as we move into, let's call it the age of iron for poetic reasons. And really we see the materials maybe change, because now maybe you're using a metal tray from the kitchen, but the same purpose exists. It's still now, we now are solidly into the litter tray era. And I do find that fascinating, that they are a thing that existed forever in naval terms, long before they became a civilian thing.
And it's one of those cases, because like you said, cats tend to get recorded when something unusual happens. And one of the unusual things is when a new cat arrives on a ship. Yeah. And sometimes you read accounts that are very amusing of people like, okay, well, we had a new cat arrive on the ship, or the ship is brand new, so they brought the first cat on board. And the more experienced sailors, the cat comes on board and everyone's kind of watching it to see where it's going to decide it wants to live, where it wants to have its litter tray. And they're kind of like, a lot of the time it'll be like, oh, we had a new cat on board, it's kind of settled in. And then you'll have things like, well, this particular cat has decided it will only sleep in like the purser's office, or this one really likes to be near the boilers. And it usually has some connection with, either people being amused or annoyed at how difficult or easy it's going to be to clean up after it.
Yeah, and there's an element of that as well. It's like, I've seen really interesting, and then from chatting, sadly, there aren't as many of them around anymore, but one of my big ongoing things has always been chatting to World War II naval veterans, Britain, US, wherever you chat to them from. They will always, and the question I always like to ask them to their immense confusion is, who was responsible for cleaning up after the cat? And what you tend to find is there's three categories of things that falls into, which is, they will always say, it's the chief hated it. If the chief hated you, of whatever section you're in, congrats, you're now permanently on cat litter tray cleaning duty. If you were the one who brought the cat on board, wasn't the official cat, that is often you'll see that, where you see, we now have a cat on board, or I brought a cat on board, or ordinary seaman X brought cat on board. I have instructed them, that's fine, but they are now responsible for maintaining the hygiene of the ship related to that cat. Sometimes it's just the unlucky guy who happened to be nearest when someone more senior spotted it and went, go clear that up. On that side of things, and maybe we'll finish in a minute by looking at some specific cats, but I do think this evolution of cat management, and that it's been happening this way in naval history for, let's say, it's probably been happening for about 5,000 years, almost, that navies have been managing this way. It's genuinely not until after World War II that this translates into civilian life. Because it's a chap called Ed Lowe who invents modern kitty litter. And that's where we get the word from. He invented the kitty litter, and it was by working out that you could use, initially he was working with sand, with ash, and then into, I think it's called desiccated soil or something like that, and then growing it from that, and built a $1 billion company out of developing cat litter and cat litter trays. And listeners, I think by now you can probably guess which branch of the military Ed Lowe served in during World War II. He's a US Navy Not a ranking officer. He's not an officer. He serves as a Navy rating and beyond. And I think he makes midshipmen, maxes out a midshipman during World War II. And it's him. He's the first guy. So once you get civilian sailors on naval vessels, they go, hang on, this is a thing that I could be telling my neighbors to do when they manage cats as well. And I do find that, like, we talk a lot about the influences the Navy has and Navy terms and Navy life has on civilian life. And I don't think people realize that one of the biggest influences the Navy has had on modern life everywhere in the world is cat litter. And I just find that fascinating.
And I think it's one of the many things that comes out of the sort of the early 20th century, because there's such a transition of technology. And also, to be honest, even anti-erodent measures, really basic things like the cones you see on mooring ropes to stop rats coming up the cabling. So even today you can get rodent problems on ships, but it's gradually, rodents are almost gradually being phased out by technological advances. But that also means that you have the tradition of having the cat on board, and it's gradually coming more and more of a tradition that and people are like, oh, this is the cat, this is the mascot. They're still doing a practical job, but it's less of a necessity than it was in perhaps the age of sail. And so as you get that kind of social transition from a working cat to a cat that's occasionally working, but is also more there for morale, you start to see, as any pet owner will know, you start to go, oh, but I think it would like this. I think they would like that. And little practical inventions as people are gradually trying to make their lives and their pets' lives better.
I think also this, you know, say, I think 75, when the Royal Navy finally officially says, no, you're not allowed cats on naval vessels now. That there are practical reasons for that. As you say, rodent control has improved massively. Cables have different protective layers on them now that are anti-munch, let's call it. All those things kick in. Ships become more complex. Ships become more contained. You know, you've got a lockdown. Both of us have visited up in Gothenburg. If you're Swedish and you've never been to the little fleet, the little historical fleet at Gothenburg, get yourself to Göteborg and visit that. There's phenomenal ships there, but you'll see a really good example of a Swedish Cold War destroyer. And how tightly locked down that ship has to be. It has to be able to operate with everything closed in case of nuclear war. And that becomes a problem for ship cats and similar. But I do know that right now, and I'm not going to name the ship, I know that there is at least one naval vessel out there right now that's running around with a ship's cat on board. So I think there is an element still to this day of where within contexts it's safe. Even where it might not be in regulation, the captain might not officially know that cat's there. The captain damn well knows that cat's there, just not officially. I know at least one cat serving on a current Navy vessel. I don't know if you've got any that you know of as well.
I've talked to various naval officers from different navies, and there's what I can think of, at least one or two that have cats that are basically, they are the ship's cat. They live aboard. They just keep out of sight when external officers arrive. And there's also a fair few where if a ship is transiting from one area to another, as we know, especially with some of the larger navies, they might have a ship is based in one area of the world for a few years, then to another. And sailors who live ashore and happen to have pet cats, perhaps with their families, much as you will sometimes see those wonderful pictures of American aircraft carriers with like half a car dealer's lot parked on their decks as when they move from, say, the Atlantic to the Pacific or something. Very often, you know, if a ship is transiting from, I don't know, the Mediterranean to the US West Coast, it's like, well, you know, the pet's coming along as well. And while he's here, they might as well earn their keep.
Well, let's finish this because we've got time to do it, which is nice. I was hoping we would. Is let's talk a bit about some of our kind of named ship cats, like a couple that we kind of know about. There's one in particular that I will absolutely mention, but I mean, just one in like obviously, for those who don't know, and we'll talk about it a bit at the end as well, is you recently wrote a book on HMS Belfast, which is, I mean, I would say it's a great book, but it is a great book. But I mean, how much in the process of that did you encounter anything about Belfast's CAS?
So yeah, they definitely seem, it's one of those, again, it's not particularly heavily documented, but it's one of those things that just crops up because for anyone who's read the book already, and for those who haven't, well, this is what you'll find, spoiler alert. I tried to incorporate quite a lot of veterans' accounts rather than just being, you know, the ship did this, this, and this, and had this many guns, and then it went and did this. I tried to let the crew's experiences speak about what they were doing as much as possible. And that meant listening to hours upon hours upon hours of recorded interviews and reading even more written interviews that have been transcribed. And it seems that at some point, as Belfast is coming out of her refit after being mined in kind of 43-ish, with her new influx of crew, she picks up a cat. And this cat is not particularly well documented. There are a few handful of photos of it, but it kind of comes and goes in the accounts, just in passing references. You know, I can think of at least three examples. I was listening to one interview where a chap who was primarily based in the boilers, so he was a stoker, and he mentioned that at one point in very rough seas, he was woken up by the cat jumping into his hammock and standing on his head and then basically just burrowing under the blankets, just going, I don't want to be here. This is horrible. And he was like, oh, okay. And literally like a 30-second mention of one night being assaulted by the cat. And there's like, okay, so we know the cat was on board the ship in late 1943, around the time of the Battle of North Cape. Then there was another mention where we're in, again, because Belfast does a lot of Arctic convoy work. But when she'd been operating in the North Sea, the cat would very frequently kind of promenade on the bow and sun itself on the gun turrets. And again, it was like a 30-second mention of somebody who said, oh yeah, well, while we're out in the Arctic, and this guy served in the superstructure, so not on the bridge, but in that general area, I think he's a radar technician. And he said he noted that the cat basically completely disavowed the open decks during the Arctic convoy missions and was very often found curled up in the radar room because obviously the radar's going and those early radars, the equipment, that the PPI scopes and stuff, they generate a lot of heat. So the cat's like, this is a nice and warm area.
Yeah.
I will sleep here. And then the last one I mentioned was that I remember was, There's a very extensive, several very extensive accounts by ship's crew and about Belfast's involvement in the D-Day landings. And of course, for a lot of that morning, Belfast is just pounding away with every gun that it's got. And I'm inferring from this that the cat wasn't particularly enthused with visiting the lower portions of the ships, because one of the guys who's serving in the magazines, but they get rotated because obviously they're handling these 6-inch shells is quite tiring. So he's on a break while someone else is taking over his duties and the ship's pounding away. And he mentions that he says basically that the pounding of the guns must have disturbed the cat, who usually liked to be in the upper portions of the ship, because he's just catching a break in the lower decks and the cat just wanders down past him, clearly looking for somewhere where it can't hear the constant percussion of the firing of the guns. And again, it's, you know, a 15-20 second excerpt where he's essentially just seen the cat come down the ladder and going, oh, what's the cat doing down here? That's weird. And then moves on with his story. And it's just those little excerpts that tell me, yeah, this cat, it's getting around. And even from those little bits, you can work out its habits and its likes and dislikes and where you might expect to find it.
Look, I think and that's why we mentioned at the top of the show the number of cats present at D-Day. Like 12 is the ones I've managed to find names for. They're there because they're on the ships. There's at least one instance I found of a landing craft having a cat. But so they're present there because they're naval. you know, once you've taken the beaches, once you're into mine clearing, once you're into to military policing and everything else, suddenly, yeah, the dog quotient is going to go up. But really, in that initial landing morning, in the big swelling sort of soundtrack moments, there's more cats there than there are dogs. And I do think people don't necessarily think about that. And those cats are providing, as on Belfast, sometimes just a sense of normalcy, normalness in a very strange time. And that's really critical, I think, particularly for young crewmen. It's just getting that almost a referent point of sort of sanity amidst everything. I don't think we should underestimate that as an important role cats play.
Oh, yeah, and absolutely. And, you know, as anyone who's been around cats or lives with cats knows, is like cats are not afraid of expressing their displeasure with things. And if you're a 18, 19, 20-year-old, maybe you've been drafted or conscripted. Maybe you've chosen the Navy to get ahead of the because you don't want to go on the as infantry. And you're sitting in a ship, and you know, especially if you're on shore bombardment duty, you've got potentially people shooting back at you. You've got the guns going off. The ship's really like this is it. This is the action. The 5 minutes of terror that people describe as that's the short bit where everyone's really scared. And you're thinking, oh, what's going to happen? Am I going to just blink and wake up in whatever afterlife I happen to believe in or whatever if the ship gets hit? But naval discipline says you can't really express that emotion because everyone else is probably feeling the same thing and they're not expressing it either. The officers are doing their job of providing leadership, so they can't show particularly much emotion. But then if you see the ship's cat just going, yeah, blow this for a game of soldiers. I'm going and finding somewhere warm and deep down in the ship where none of this nonsense is going to disturb me. The cat doesn't have to say anything, but just by its actions, you're like, okay, no, someone else actually understands. Yeah, this is not the most pleasant thing.
Normal way to feel.
Yes. Yeah,
the cat can become a representation of views. I've seen this in letters. It's one of the things I've seen where cats are mentioned, where people take great glee when a cat dislikes a senior officer that everyone else dislikes, because the cat will often make its dislike far more obvious than those working for that officer can. So you know, there is the accounts. I've read at least one account of a cat that developed a habit of defecating in a certain officer's hat because he didn't like the officer. And there's multiple letters from crewmen just going, happened again yesterday. This is great. there is a sort of, yeah, the cats are very open with their feelings, and those feelings often reflect the feelings of those around them as well. I mean, maybe that's why we should finish with my favorite cat of service, which is actually post-war, which is Sea Cat Simon. And I think sometimes with some of the cat stories, there's sometimes a lot of myth and not a lot of history around them. So, I mean, we could do another podcast on sea cats that are meant to have done things that didn't do those things, i.e. serve on the Bismarck and everything else. But I mean, Simon is very much a real world story, and he's actually the ship's cat of HMS Amethyst. And he's picked up in about 1948 by a young ordinary seaman as they're in Hong Kong, actually. So we were talking earlier about ships needing cats. He's a little tuxedo cat, and he's clearly grown up as a kitten in the dockyards, and the ordinary seaman just said, well, we haven't got a ship's cat, this will do. Takes him on board, tries to keep him secret for a while, both him and some of the crew. They absolutely fail because very quickly Simon decides that the best place on the ship to sleep, on this destroyer to sleep, is the captain's cabin. Lieutenant commander in charge effectively discovers Simon exists when he finds him sleeping in his hat. but luckily he's a cat man, so lets him stay. And because of the rodent control, particularly on station there, but it's effectively on the 30th of July, 1949, in the middle of the Chinese Revolution, Amethyst is sent upriver. It's sent up the Yangtze River to effectively act as a garrison ship, and relieve HMS Consort, further up the river. The Chinese Revolutionary Forces mistake her for a US vessel trying to make a move on them. And they shell her heavily. And this is a destroyer who's not particularly well reinforced on her sides. And she's hit hard, and she's actually temporarily beached. And she's stuck under their guns. I mean, and we're talking 50 crew are killed or wounded in that action, including the ship's captain. There's a shell that goes straight through and destroys the captain's cabin. And the ship is effectively stranded under the guns of the Chinese. And they're stuck there until the British can find a way of getting that ship out. If they try and move, they're fired on again. And this is exactly that situation we were talking of earlier, isn't it? The crew are not going to be, they're going to be scared and they're going to be worried in that situation, aren't they?
Yeah. And I mean, it's, they're scared. And also because, as you said, you know, Simon likes to sleep in the captain's cabin. So the captain is a lieutenant commander. He's actually badly wounded in this initial shelling. So, and that's for him, that's fatal. But Simon is also hit quite badly by the same shell. And I think in a lot of ways, it's kind of, it provides the crew again with this kind of ability to focus their emotions, because from a purely utilitarian, very cold-blooded standpoint, people go, oh, okay, well, the ship's cat's been hit badly. That's a tragedy. I guess we'll get a new one. But instead, the crew take the Simon and they take him to the medical bay, and he gets as much, if not more, treatment than the men who have been wounded.
Yeah, he gets. They think he's going to die. They operate on him. He's badly wounded in his back legs. His whiskers are singed off. Everything else. But yeah, the medical midshipman operates and manages to save Simon's life. And the ship is now stranded for a considerable period of time. I mean, we're talking, it's about 20 days that it's stuck under these guns. As you say, the captain's dead. There's a new captain has to be sent down to them and is sort of almost smuggled down, which is a guy called Lieutenant Commander Kearns, who isn't a catman. All the previous captains on that ship have been a catman. And actually, his first instruction when he has arrived is almost what you said there, Drac. He's like, we do not have time to be dealing with a cat right now. That cat, next time we're probably on shore, stick that cat off ashore. But as Simon starts to recover, he becomes that massive, important morale boost. He meets two girls again. I mean, there's an incredible letter I've read, which talks about how when they committed their dead to the river, when they put them over the side, when the crew were assembled and for the funeral, he remembers turning around and seeing Simon standing almost watch over the draped bodies as they were putting them in the water. He dragged himself out of the medical bay to come and be present for that. He then spent the next days in the medical bay with the crewmen who survived but were wounded. He would just sleep on their beds. He would sleep next to them. He would provide them with that reassurance. And then as soon as he could vaguely move again, he started hunting rats again, which now that they're stranded on a riverbank and they can't get supplies is even more critical. I think so on about the 20th of, but towards the end of July, they manage to get out. And then they evacuate. In fact, I think it's the 30th they evacuate on. I think they first get beached actually earlier than that. It's beginning of the month. But when they do get away, they do get a campaign or a ribbon awarded. The sailors get what's known as the Amethyst Medal for service under fire and the duty they did there. The crew petition to make sure that Simon gets awarded that as well. Kearns, the commander who hated cats, became ill during their marooning on the river. And he woke one morning to find Simon purring away at him and snuggled into his side. And that's the point where Kearns promotes Simon to able sea cat rank. You know, he's won over his new commander. But yeah, so he gets an Amethyst campaign medal. Now, unofficially, I suspect there was an element of over-ordering medals, so they made sure they had one to give him. But he, on the 10th of August 1949, he's actually confirmed as a recipient of the Dickin Medal, which is pretty special, isn't it?
Yeah, it was basically, it's the animal version of the Victoria Cross. You have to do something quite remarkable to get that.
It's the highest, effectively the highest medal of gallantry that can be awarded to an animal in military service. Simon's confirmed as the recipient. He is still to this day the only cat ever to be awarded that medal. It's a fascinating medal. We should do an episode on it at some point. But like, if you go down the list of recipients, it's dogs, it's pigeons, it's everything else. Simon is the only cat ever to receive it. For just what he did to that ship in terms of crew morale, in terms of rat hunting, whilst grievously wounded, And I do like, there is part of me that goes, yeah, there's a reason cats don't get courage medals a lot. And it's because, as you said earlier, like when that firing starts, they're going straight down to the deepest point of the ship. They're like, this is a human problem now. This is not a cat problem. But we should note really that this does have a slightly sad ending, because Simon never really fully recovers from his wounds. And so when HMS Amethyst is kind of recalled to Britain, the plan is that when she gets back, Simon will be awarded his full Dickin medal. But when they reach back to the UK, he falls ill. He becomes even iller during the quarantine period, when he's in quarantine. And I always found it quite telling of the relationship between a crew and their cat, that during his condition worsened, there was always a member of HMS Amethyst's crew sitting next to him, standing watch within the veterinary facility. The vets were not happy about it. The crew were like, no, he was there for us. There will be a fully uniformed sailor with him at all times. And sadly, he actually passes away on the 28th of November in 1949. He is buried now. He's buried with full military honours. And he's actually buried in Ilford Pet Cemetery, which is not far away from where I am in East London. And I will admit that, like, generally around Remembrance Day, I normally jump on the bus and pop up there. His grave's still there.
And well maintained.
And it is, if you're in London, it is actually relatively easy to visit. And there's a lot of other Dickin medal recipients in that little pet cemetery. A lot of dogs that did bomb service in World War II. It's absolutely worth a visit. But yeah, he's buried with full military honours. And I think nothing speaks more to the role of cats on vessels than that. The crew are present when he's buried. There is a Union Jack draped over his small coffin. And if you go there today, you can still see the inscription, I think, on it. The subscription sums up and is maybe the thing we'll finish the podcast with. So before I read that out, Drac, where can people find you?
So you can find me mostly online on my YouTube channel, DracNFL. Fairly easy to search. I've got a website, DracNFL.co.uk. You can pick up my book on HMS Belfast, which we've mentioned in part during this. And yeah, those are the main places you'll find me. I did finally also manage recently to claw my official Facebook identity off of one of these annoying Facebook accounts that renames themselves constantly. Oh, yeah. I managed to get them done for copyright violation. So now I also have a official Facebook page, but it's like 10 people, so probably not the best place.
Yeah, and your own website as well. I mean, I always give a shout out to that, because you've got a huge photo archive, which I think is incredible and so useful to me as a historian. And if you're a naval historian or just interested in that kind of thing, and you're not familiar with the image library you've got there of scanned images, it is incredibly powerful. And I think that, I mean, so thanks very much for joining me. I'm gonna finish. Listeners, listen again next week. If you've enjoyed this podcast, if you like this kind of thing, do tell us on the socials. Do tell us on in the places where we discuss these things. And you never know, you might get me and Drac talking about dogs on ships in future, or pigeons on ships, which is actually really interesting. But I'll leave with this, the inscription that you will find today if you visit Sea Cat Simon's grave in Ilford. And that inscription reads, "In memory of Simon, served in HMS Amethyst, May 1948 to September 1949, awarded Dickin Medal, August 1949, died 28th of November, 1949. Throughout the Yangtze incident, his behaviour was of the highest order." You've been listening to the Untitled History Podcast, a Battle Guide production. If you've enjoyed this episode and would like to support the podcast, why not head over to our dedicated supporter page? There, for the cost of a cup of tea, you can decide which subjects we cover next, get access to exclusive behind-the-scenes content, and join a community of like-minded people. Thanks for listening, and we'll see you next time. It's such a naval thing, that last line. Yeah. His behavior was of the highest order.
Yeah. I also like the citation he gets for the Amethyst campaign.
Yeah, it's the hunting down Chairman Mao, isn't it?
Yeah.
And all of that kind of
That's such a naval thing. He's like, this rat is a massive pestilence to us. Yeah, let's move him off to the enemy leader, and then the cat can kill him.